Hello, you are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth, Lecture 6. I have already dealt with several matters concerning the period between death and rebirth, and in the last lecture said a little about the relation of Christian Rosenkreuz to Buddha. I pointed out that Buddha has been connected with a planetary sphere, the Mars sphere, since the time then mentioned, and that after man has passed through the Christ event between death and rebirth on the sun, he lives on further into the Mars sphere, and there undergoes the Buddha experience in the manner that is right and normal for the present age. We have to understand this Buddha experience in the way that is suitable for the present age, not in the manner which was correct for the age in which that individuality lived on earth as Gautama Buddha. The only true explanation of the nature of man and his connection with the evolution of the whole world is obtained by following this evolution with one's understanding. We know that in the post-Atlantean epoch there have been 5 consecutive ages during which human souls have undergone important experiences. These are the ancient Indian, the Persian, the Egypto-Chaldean, the Greco-Latin ages, and our own. We also know that in each of these ages, the germ of the next was to a certain extent prepared. In our age, the 6th is already being slowly prepared in human souls. And this preparation consists in their learning to understand that which is now being given out as occult teaching, anthroposophy, etc. This imparts not only a knowledge of the nature of man as a whole, which is necessary for his future life, but also what may be described as a continual deepening of the understanding of the Christ impulse. All that contributes to this understanding of the Christ impulse in our age is summed up for the West in what may be called the mystery of the Holy Grail. The mystery of the Holy Grail is also connected with such things as were explained when we spoke of the bestowal by Christian Rosenkreuz of the mission of Mars on Buddha. The mystery of the Holy Grail can give the modern man that which leads him to an understanding of the life between death and rebirth that is correct for the present age. In order to arrive at this understanding, it will be necessary for us to endeavor to answer an important question. And unless we go more deeply into this question than we have hitherto done, we shall not be able to carry our studies of the life between death and rebirth further. The question is, why, in the teaching of Christianity, up to the present time, have certain teachings fallen into the background, which have now to be introduced into what may be called the advanced teaching? And this, even where the deeper side of Christianity has to a certain extent been taught. You know that everything connected with the reincarnation and karma has withdrawn not only from the outer exoteric teaching of Christianity, but also from the more esoteric teachings and revelations of past centuries. Anyone listening to the teachings of anthroposophy may ask, how is it, although we are taught that Rosicrucianism is to accompany all that spiritual science has to give, how is it that hitherto, even up to our own times, Rosicrucianism did not possess the teachings of reincarnation and karma? How is that the teaching of reincarnation and karma has had to be added to Rosicrucianism in our day? If we wish to understand this, we must once more consider the whole relation of man to the world from a certain point of view. The preliminary conditions for the study we wish to take up in these lectures have been given in my book Occult Science. But we must consider what the relation of man is to the world in our day, in the period which has been prepared through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods. We know that earthly man consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and capital I, together with all that appertains to these. And we know that when man passes through the portal of death, he first leaves behind his physical body. Then after a time, the greater part of his etheric body is dissolved in the world ether. And he then takes with him further, something which is a kind of extract of the etheric body. For a long time, the astral body accompanies him, and then, from this also, something like an envelope is cast aside when the period in Kamaloka is at an end. An extract, however, of the etheric body and of the astral body continues into the further life which man has to pass through between death and rebirth. In its inmost being, the human I or ego remains unchanged. Whether the human being is passing through the period here in the physical body between birth and death, whether he is passing through the period during which he is still fully surrounded by the astral body, or whether he is passing through the period in the spirit world, which comprises the greater portion of the life between death and rebirth, it is fundamentally the I which goes through all these periods. This I, the real, the true I, must not be confused with what man knows on earth in the physical body as his I. Philosophers talk a great deal about this human ego in the physical, earthly body, and they think they understand it. For example, it is said that this ego is maintained, even though everything else in man changes. The true ego, or I, is indeed permanent. But whether the ego, of which the philosophers speak, is permanent, is a different question. One who talks a great deal about the preservation of this ego, of which the philosophers speak, is contradicted by the fact that during the night man goes to sleep, and this ego is then extinguished. It is not there. And if the whole period between death and rebirth were like the period during sleep, we could not say much about the permanence of the human soul after death. With regard to immortality, it is not so much a question as to whether the ego exists, but that it should also know something of itself. Thus, the immortality of the ego, which lives in human consciousness, is refuted every time we sleep during the night. For this ego, or I, is then simply obliterated. But the true ego lies much deeper, very much deeper. How can we acquire a conception of this true ego, even though we cannot yet rise to the sphere of spiritual science? We may think as follows. The I must be present in a human being, even when he cannot as yet say I, when he still creeps about on the floor. The real I is then already present, not the I of which the philosopher speaks, and it manifests itself in a remarkable manner. Let us consider this for a moment. To external science, the way in which we study a human being in the first months or years of his life will seem to be very unimportant. But to one who wishes to understand human nature, it is most important to do this. At first, the human being creeps upon all fours, and he has to make a special effort to rise from this position, from this subjection to gravity, to assume the vertical position and to maintain himself in it. That is one thing. A second is the following. We know that in the first part of his life, man cannot speak. He has to learn to speak. Try to remember how you first learned to speak, how you learned to say the first word you were able to utter, and how you then learned to form your first sentence. Try to remember this. But without the aid of clairvoyance, your efforts will be in vain. Without clairvoyance, you will be able to remember as little of it as you can remember your first effort to rise from the creeping position to the vertical one. A third thing is thinking. Memory reaches back as far as to the time when one was able to think, but not beyond this time. Who is the active principle in this learning to walk, to speak, and to think? It is the true ego. What then does this true ego do? Let us consider for a moment what it does. From the very beginning, man is destined to walk upright, to speak, and to think, but he is unable to do so immediately. He is not at once able to do that which, as earthly man, he is destined to do. He does not at first possess that by means of which he lives within human civilization. He has to acquire it gradually. In the first period of his life, the spirit which dwells in him when he is upright combats the spirit which is in him when he is subject to gravity. And when the capacity to think and speak has not yet evolved in him. Thus we see that when man has fulfilled his destiny, as it were, and can stand and walk in an upright position, can speak and think, he is an expression of what is contained in the human form. To walk upright, to speak, and to think correspond naturally to the human form. It is impossible to imagine another being able to walk like man, with a vertical spine, and able to speak and think, without its having the human form. Even a parrot, when it can talk, can only do this because it has an upright position. This capacity is connected interiorly with the vertical line. Animals which are much more intelligent do not learn to talk, because their spine is not vertical but horizontal. There are other things, however, that belong to this. We see that man cannot at first assume the position destined for him. This is because after the efforts his true ego has made, and which have given him thought, speech, and the vertical position, man is at length embedded, as it were, in the sphere in which live the spirits of form, the exousiae. These spirits of form, who in the Bible are called the Elohim, are the beings from whom the human form, in which the human ego naturally dwells, really originates, and on which it sets their imprint during the early months and years of life. But there are other spirits who oppose them, and who cast man down, who throw him below the level of the spirits of form. What spirits are these? The spirits of form are those who enable man to learn to speak, to think, and to walk upright. The spirits who cast him down, so that he moves on all fours, so that he can neither speak nor think in the first part of his life, are spirits whom he has first to overcome in life, who, to begin with, give him an incorrect form. They are spirits who really ought to be spirits of motion, dynamis, but they have fallen behind in their evolution, and are not yet even at the standpoint of the spirits of form. They are luciferic spirits who act upon man from outside, consigning him to the element of gravity, from which he has gradually to raise himself by aid of the true spirits of form. When we observe man as he enters at birth into physical existence, we see in the efforts he makes to give himself what he ought to have later in life, the true progressing spirits of form fighting with the spirits who ought to be spirits of motion, but have remained behind at an earlier stage. We see the spirits of form battling with luciferic spirits, and in this realm the luciferic spirits are so powerful that they prevent the consciousness of the ego, which is then at work, from appearing. If luciferic spirits did not suppress this consciousness, man would be able at that period in his life to realize that he was a fighter, to feel that he was in the horizontal position, and that he consciously willed to assume the vertical position, that he willed to learn to speak and think. He cannot do all this, because at the time he is enveloped by luciferic spirits. From this we gain a dim perception of what we shall gradually learn to recognize as the true I, in contradistinction to the I which first appears in the consciousness. At the commencement of this course of lectures, we said that we should try gradually to justify to the healthy human intellect what anthroposophy and what seership have to say regarding the nature of man. But this healthy human intellect must really desire to notice how man enters gradually into the physical world in the early period of his life. What is most finished in man when he enters into life? The external form is then not really very notable, for man at that time contradicts his outer form. He has first to assume the form destined for him. What then is most finished in man, not only after birth but also before it? It is the head. Of all the physical organs, it is the part that is really most distinctly developed, even in the embryo. Why is this? It is because the various organs in man are by no means interwoven by beings of the higher hierarchies all in the same way, but the various parts are interwoven by them differently, the head in one way, the trunk in another. The head is essentially different from the rest of the physical body of man. When we observe the human head clairvoyantly, we see that it is distinguished from all of the parts of the body, from the hand, for example, in a very remarkable way. When we move our hand, the physical hand and the etheric part of the hand behind it move in the same way. But when a certain stage of clairvoyance has been attained, it is possible for the clairvoyant to keep the physical hand still and move only the etheric hand. It is a particularly important exercise to keep movable parts still and only move the etheric parts. By doing this, the progressive clairvoyance of the future will be developed more and more, whereas all yielding to motions which are made unconsciously is a revival of dervishism, which at the present time has been overcome. Repose of the physical body is the characteristic of present-day clairvoyance. All sorts of convulsive and similar movements were the characteristic of ancient times. Therefore, it would be something quite special if, for example, the clairvoyant were to keep his hands in a certain position, let us say crossed over the breast, and maintained great mobility of his etheric hands, so that he did all sorts of things with these in the supersensible worlds, while he kept his physical hands quiet. That would indicate a special development in which man would express himself with respect to his hands. Now there is an organ in man, the etheric part of which moves freely, while the corresponding physical part remains still, without his being clairvoyant. This organ is the brain, the organ where the cosmic order has formed the solid skull round the lobes of the brain. These would like to move, but they cannot. Therefore, in an ordinary person, there always exists, with respect to the brain, what exists in the clairvoyant when, for example, he moves only his etheric hands and keeps his physical hands at rest. To a clairvoyant, a head is something quite different from what it seems to be to an ordinary person. For, to the clairvoyant, the brain is something which extends beyond the head in snake-like or tongue-like forms. Every head is a Medusa head. This is something which is very real. It is the difference between the human head and the rest of the body. With respect to the rest of the body, man will only gain through further evolution what in the case of the head is ordinary outer thinking. In a certain respect, the strength of thought consists in the circumstance that man is able to bring his brain to rest while he is thinking, even down to the more subtle, invisible movements, the movements of the nerves. His thoughts become more subtle, more peaceful, more logical, the quieter the brain is when he is thinking, quiet even to the finer movements which are the movements of the nerves. Thus, when man enters into existence at birth, his head is the most perfect part, because there has already taken place in it that which, in the case of the hands, that part of man which expresses itself in gestures, can only be gained in the future. In the ancient moon period, that which is now the brain was still at the stage our hands are at now. The head was then open on many sides. It was not yet enclosed by the skull. Whereas now it is imprisoned, it could at that time move out in every direction. This, however, was on the ancient moon, when man was still in a fluid condition. Even at a certain period in the Lemurian epoch, when man was at the stage of evolution which repeated the ancient moon period, it was still the case that from a fissure at the top of the head there appeared not only the organ we have so often mentioned, but something like a bubbling forth of thought into the fluid element. There also existed a sort of fiery vapor which developed in the human element, even as late as among the ancient Atlanteans. Without having an abnormal clairvoyance, but with the clairvoyance possessed in Atlantis by every man, it could be seen whether a person was a, in quotes, thinker in the ancient Atlantean sense, or whether he was not. One who was a thinker had a shining fiery light, a kind of shining vapor over his head, and one who did not think went about without it. These are things which have first to be known if we wish to understand the change that occurs in human nature from the period when man lives here in the physical body, passes through the portal of death, and enters upon the other period between death and rebirth. All that which works upon man, so that he may come into being, disappears to a certain extent once he has entered the physical world, but it becomes particularly important when he has laid aside the physical body. During the period between birth and death, man does not perceive the forces which have built up the physical human brain, but all he does perceive in the period between birth and death falls away as something unimportant when he passes the portal of death. He then lives within the forces of which he is unconscious during physical earthly life. Whereas in physical earthly life he experiences his conceptive I, in quotes, in his waking state, between death and rebirth he experiences the I of which we gain a dim idea when we consider a human being who is learning to walk, speak, and think. The ordinary man is unconscious of this. It does not reach his consciousness. Now, we can trace back to the period of birth and prior to birth that which remains unconscious and entirely veiled, and we can also trace it still further back when we observe the period after death. That which is most veiled, because it has constructed man, and which disappears during earthly life, is most present when he is not an earthly man, namely, in the period after death. The forces of which we can only gain a dim idea, which make man from within into a walking being, and produce the sounds that are language, which make him into a thinker, which form the brain into the organ of thought, and are the most important forces when man is living the life between death and rebirth, then only does his true ego appear. In the next lecture, we shall describe how it appears. The end of Lecture 6.